I'm your host, Rena Friedman Watts, and this is the Better Call Daddy Show.
Hey, this is Big Daddy, Wayne Friedman.
That's my grandpa. Grandpa, you ready for more daddy drama?
My dad is my number one hero and number one fan.
And I'm a pretty cool dude.
All right, season four, baby, here we go.
More stories you're not going to believe.
And maybe you will after you listen.
5 stars.
5.5 stars, 2 thumbs up.
You are a pretty cool dude.
Love you, Mommy.
Don't stand on the table and damn the public. You'll get some words of wisdom to live by.
Here we go again. Better call Daddy.
You know what your problem is? You like me.
Yeah, I do. Each week, I interview a guest, share the stories with my dad, and then he weighs in at the end of every episode with his wisdom and wit.
Hey, Grandpa.
Everyone from influential players to inspirational fathers and, of course, controversial people.
Grandpa, my mom is calling.
Creating that legacy one call at a time. And welcome to the Better Call Daddy Show.
Stay tuned.
Where's the music?
Better call Daddy because he knows you best. Better call Daddy because he's bringing the test. He sees possibilities. Better call Daddy, you're the apple of his eye. He sees possibilities. All to be.
My dad said that today's episode is a difficult one, especially being a dad to 3 daughters. He said sex can either be a tool for love and compassion or coldness and destruction. Today's guest reached out to me, Kelly Wallace, after listening to my episode with Reese Quibble. She said, I'm a sexual assault survivor and an alcoholic in recovery since 2001. When she was just 8 years old, she testified in court against her perpetrator, who was her paternal grandfather. A large portion of alcoholics and addicts have been touched by sexual abuse, but this fact often gets overlooked. She speaks honestly and candidly about being a survivor and her path to healing, including years of therapy. My dad also said that these perpetrators have no sensitivity of guilt. He called them sick bastards, and he said they have no guilt because they too have suffered abuse and it needs to be stopped generationally. Kelly, welcome to the Better Call Daddy Show.
I listened to your story.
Thanks.
I told my dad about your story. And the first thing that we both said is like, you know, obviously, oh my God. But then we put it into context in our own family. Like, you know, if my grandfather mm-hmm. were to have done that.
Yeah.
I could never, I don't think, forgive him, understand him, want a relationship with him.
Never want a relationship with that person. Yeah, ever. Yeah.
And, you know, I have a daughter. I am a mom of 4.
Mm.
So then, you know.
And then it hits differently when you're a mom, too. Yeah. I'm not.
It really does.
Yeah.
It really does. I'm like, oh, my God, if my dad were to do that to my daughter. And then we had a conversation about that. Mm-hmm. And he was like, my dad honestly said that I would rather kill myself. That's what my dad said. That's a crazy response from my dad to say that.
That is a crazy response. Yeah, I've never heard anyone say it that way before. Yeah.
How did you get brave enough to share your story and to have the confidence to tell?
You know, I think since I've been telling my story from a very young age, I had to tell my story to complete strangers, to officers of the court, to police detectives. I had to tell my story to my mom. Yeah, I had to tell it over and over and over. And so in a court setting with complete strangers listening. So I think I got comfortable telling that story from a young age. And I want to say in like 8th grade, I began telling my friends about, you know, my experience, like not the whole story, but like, hey, I testified when I was 8 against my grandfather for sexually abusing me. And like no one believed me. And so getting the support and validation from my friends was super important for me as I, you know, went into high school and started talking about it there as well with friends there. And again, not telling entire versions of the story in its entirety, but just bits and pieces here and there. And so, yeah, I got really comfortable. My mom was very open about it. So I talked with her about it over the years. And so it just kind of just became like almost like a piece of folklore within our family. You know, I mean, we were a very small family unit. It was growing up, it was just my mom and my sister and I, because we were basically shunned effectively by the paternal family. My mom is from Maine. We live in Oregon. So all of my relatives were back east. And so we just didn't have the physicality to be close to those people who I didn't really know. I mean, so yeah, I just got real comfortable talking about it from a very early age. So
how did your friends respond to that?
I mean, people,
because you were so young.
As I got into high school, more and more people, you know, it's a very, you know, sexual assault. It's like everywhere. It affects so many people.
Yeah.
And if you're a woman, it's almost like if you haven't been affected by it, it's really kind of like, what? You haven't been affected by it? How? Tell me how. And so
how'd you skirt that? Yeah.
How'd you get out of that? And so when I would tell my story, people would come to me and they would be comfortable telling me what happened to them, you know? And so I had a lot of friends who just told me their own experiences. And I became almost like someone that they could go to about those experiences and talk about it. And I also had early intervention therapy right after I disclosed to my mom, and I had, you know, access to some resources that a lot of kids do not have access to. So also sharing my story in therapeutic settings, I think, where I was accepted and heard without questioning, was so important as well. So that also probably led to that being able to tell it to lots of people in all kinds of different settings.
That is fortunate that you were believed in that kind of setting, because I don't think government agencies are as
set up.
Yeah, there you go. That's a nice way of putting it. I mean, walking into a courtroom must have been scary.
It was really terrifying for me. It was like walking into a battlefield, like a mine field, with people that my relatives, my paternal relatives, filled basically every seat behind my grandfather. They were there supporting him. So these people that I had grown up with and, you know, knew as a child were suddenly like against me. And so that was intimidating. The judge was intimidating. He was that, you know, there's a court reporter. And when I was testifying, I was like nodding my head or shaking my head. And the judge was like, Kelly, you have to say yes or no. I mean, so I was getting kind of reprimanded by this old, the judge was old. And so it was really scary. It was really scary. And seeing my grandfather with his high-powered attorneys, he had two high-powered attorneys who were white men. My grandfather is a white man. He had a cowboy hat that he wore. He had a whole collection of them in his closets. I remember, you know, growing up playing hide and seek and seeing all those cowboy hats. And then in a courtroom, you know, it was on the table or the desk where he sat with those attorneys, and just trying to avoid him, avoid the cowboy hat in my line of sight was just really, it was a nightmare.
I feel like that would be triggering to even see that hat, like you're mentioning.
Totally triggering. You know, my experience at 8 was that I was having meltdown after meltdown on the witness stand because the questioning, the invasive questioning about what happened to me was too much. It was just way too much. Like the attorney for the state, the district attorney that was representing the state, he had to call recess after recess because I could not hold it together. I was like crying. And like my mom describes it as like catatonic. And so, you know, but again, getting down off the witness stand, having to go through that sea of relatives to go outside the courtroom doors. And there were relatives outside the courtroom doors too. So I had to walk past them to go into the restroom to like splash cold water on my face and pull myself, as my mom said, pull myself together. You just have to testify for a little while. And it was insane. It was incredibly cruel. And, you know, yeah. I didn't really have a choice in the matter. It was never really, it was like, you need to do this to potentially lock your grandfather up. And there was no discussion of, do you want to do this? It was more like, yeah, there was no choice. And that, you know, I have really mixed feelings about that because, yes, I was strong, but at what cost, you know, to be sexually abused, victimized, and then to be re-traumatized by a court process, a court system that only further traumatized me.
That's so hard.
It's awful.
I can't even believe they made you see him. Like, how come they couldn't talk to you not in front of all of those people?
Well, back in those days, they did not have, like today, I think there are more choices, there are more options, there's closed captioning where you can be in another room and you're just, yeah, your picture is beamed in from another room in the courthouse and you don't have to see the person, the perpetrator as a child, which is just, yeah, incredibly cruel. I mean, it's like, that was 1985. And so even, you know, I don't know if you were familiar with like the Dylan Farrow or, you know, Woody Allen, the filmmaker, yeah. Woody Allen.
Yes.
Well, in 1991, Dylan Farrow, who's the adopted daughter of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen, came out and said that she was being molested by Woody Allen. And he used his powers to effectively shut her down. But there was enough evidence to bring him to trial in Connecticut. And so, because the crimes happened in Connecticut and New York. And the district attorney in Connecticut decided that she was not strong enough. She was around the same age. She was like six or seven or eight.
Oh my God.
And she was given that choice. And there's a documentary that came out about it several years ago called Allen versus Farrow. It's a very good documentary. I highly recommend it. But the district attorney ended up talking to her and they filmed it about, you know, how he didn't feel she was strong enough to be on the witness stand. And it's like they must have seen something in me or felt like my testimony was going to be strong enough to get through that whole process. So
who makes that decision even?
I think it's probably at the district attorney makes that decision and the judge together, maybe. I don't know exactly. That is actually a really good question that I don't know the answer to. So
yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy that, I don't know, that they felt like you could see those perpetrators and that you could tell your story in a calm manner mm-hmm. in front of them. That to me is just like, does not make sense.
Totally. Totally. It was a different time. We just didn't treat crime victims the way that we do now. There's just like a whole different process. There's still a long ways to go, but it's just a very different process than it was back then. So
I'm also interested, like, do you feel like this is part of your purpose?
I kind of wonder if that is part of my purpose, like here on earth in kind of a woo-woo way, you know, like to be a voice for those that can't speak up, because most sexual assault survivors can't speak up about what happened. Lots of them have buried memories because of the traumatic nature of the crimes that were committed against them. So oftentimes what will happen is child will be sexually abused, like usually by a family member and in the home. And then they will obviously leave the home. And a lot of people have what we call recovered memories in their, they usually come out in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. Lots of times childbirth or becoming a mom will reignite, you know, because they'll realize that their children are going to become the same age that they were when this started happening to them. So that's very, very, very common. My story is very unique because I told right away and I was believed. And my experience is very rare. Most people are not believed. And so children have to tell an average of 7 or 8 times before they are believed. And, you know, there's a lot of focus on like coaches, priests, Boy Scout leaders, but a lot of it happens within the family and people don't want to talk about it. And it's generational. Like, it's generational on both sides of my family. Like, my mom was molested. My grandmother was molested, my maternal grandmother. And on my dad's side, I mean, my grandfather was effectively raised by other cowboys in Eastern Oregon. His mom abandoned him during the Great Depression. And these cowboys, it's a very rural kind of country, you know, super country out there. And so, like, my grandfather was probably molested by these cowboys that he was living with. And then he just repeated that behavior. I'm sure there's so many members of my paternal family that have also been molested by my grandfather. And like I said, it's just generational.
Have you wanted to talk to those other family members later in life?
Yes and no, because most of those people shunned me. I'm very hesitant to do so. I actually had a female cousin, find me on MySpace. And this is MySpace in like 2008. And she came forward and said that she had been molested by my grandfather and, you know, confirmed my suspicions. But she told me that several of her siblings, female siblings, had also been likely molested by him, and that we compared notes and we were basically molested in the same way, in the same fashion. And so it confirmed for me that, you know, there are others. As I suspected, my grandfather was also a school board member. He was a member of, or he was a volunteer. He's the chaperone with the Future Farmers of America and 4-H, which is the largest youth organization in the United States and bigger than Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts combined. And so this cousin that found me, unfortunately, was not well. She was just not mentally, she couldn't pull it together enough to really, I couldn't have a relationship with her just because of her mental health state. And so I chose not to continue a relationship with her based on what happened. And so the other thing too is that there were some family members that, you know, when my allegations came out and even before they came out, there were whispers that it was kind of known. It was like an open secret that my grandfather should not be left alone with females. My godmother told my mom at one point, like when my sister and I were going on visits to my grandparents' house, my dad was living with my grandparents at the time. And the godmother was saying, you know, I wouldn't leave Kelly alone. I wouldn't leave. Mm-mm. So yeah, there were people that knew and let it happen. So there's people that are complicit. So like I said, it's such a complex question because it's like all these years later, how would I know who to trust? Who's going to believe me?
I was wondering that. How are you able to trust people?
As an adult, I mean, you know, this has been one of my core issues as an adult is trusting people because that's what you're left with. You know, you're left with, my therapist that I worked with for a long time said, you're basically, as an adult survivor of incest, you're basically left with a big pile of anxiety and trust issues. Even if you've been able to work through a lot of stuff, like I've been able to work through a lot of stuff in therapy, but yeah, it's at the crux of my romantic relationships, you know, it's like, how do you trust? Yeah, how do you trust? And, you know, I've been kind of like very independent for most of my life. And I think there's a reason for that, you know, like I like to do things for myself, by myself, because I'm the only one I can trust, you know, and it's just, that's the reality of, you know, like I've never been married. I've had relationships, but they've been, romantic relationships have been really challenging. And that is something that I struggle with to this day as a result of what happened to me.
Yeah, I would imagine that that would be really hard. I am curious if you have done things in your life like martial arts or singing or hobbies or hiked a 10K or done things that have given you power there.
Totally. Yeah. I've been, you know, when I was in my mom, you know, started jogging when I was 10. And I took that up and, you know, I've been a jogger runner most of my life. And I've had periods where I've struggled with injuries. But in 2018, I travel very independently. I've traveled extensively internationally by myself. I almost made it to the top of a volcano, the third tallest volcano in Europe called Mount Pico. It's on this little island in the Azores, which is a set of islands off of Portugal. Yeah. And so my fear of heights kept me from reaching the very tippy top, but I made it to the main crater, which was pretty amazing to me. I've done, you know, in 2012 or 2014, I can't remember which, I did a 100-mile bike. Yeah, it's called a century. So like I've done a lot of physical activities that, you know, are challenges because I love a challenge and I'm just joined a climb gym. And so, you know, I love, yeah, working out has been a huge outlet for me in my lifetime. So, yeah.
I feel like working out helps me with my mental health. That's kind of, and also creativity. So that's why I kind of asked about that because I feel like when you have hardships, if you can, you know, divert your mind in a positive way towards other healthy habits that can be really therapeutic.
Totally. Yeah. I joined Jazzercise. I did Jazzercise from 2014 to 2018. Oh my gosh, it was amazing. I loved it. It was, there are no leg warmers, but, you know, dancing was a way for me. In Jazzercise, there's a lot of dancing and there's like, you know, kickboxing elements and Pilates elements. And that was a way for me to really like connect with my body. And it was really challenging because it's hard for me to be in my body sometimes. Running is different because I can be in my head, but, you know, with dancing, it's like you have to be coordinated. You have to, you know, you have to be able to follow, you know, like the different beats, and that really forces you to check in with your body. And it's great. I mean, I think I've outlived that Jazzercise. Maybe I'll return to it someday, but
that's cute. I love that. Yeah, yeah. I like Zumba too.
Yeah, it's like Zumba. Yeah.
That's cute.
Yeah.
Have you had any like spiritual awakenings, or do you believe in God?
I've struggled with organized religion most of my life. Like I never really grew up in any type of organized religion, but I'm a member of several 12-step programs. So there's a lot of talk of God and like a lot of like 12-step literature and stuff of that nature. But God can be anything that you want it to be. And so the way that, you know, I connect with, you know, like universe, I can definitely connect with like the universe through like hiking and being out in nature and definitely just touching, like, I don't know if you're familiar with like the concept of earthing or grounding. Like there's a whole thing about like, you know, if you're feeling like frazzled or out of your body, you can just go take your shoes off and stand in your front yard and like just connect your feet to the earth. And it's very kind of woo. I mean, I live in Oregon and we're kind of like California in that way. But in even just, you know, like spring is here and there's a whole bunch of weeds in my yard. And so just pulling those weeds is a good way for me to like touch into nature and get that connection with the earth. That it's kind of like the dancing element. It's like getting in touch with myself, getting in touch with my body or something bigger than myself.
I love that. Have you kind of thought about your purpose or your mission, what you want your legacy to be?
That's an interesting question. I think that, as we kind of touched on earlier, like I think my purpose in life has been to be a resource for others, but also, you know, I've done well in like my professional life. A go-getter, like I'm the firstborn, like I was the first grandchild child on my paternal side. And so that like first child energy is real strong with me. So, you know, I have a successful business. You know, during the pandemic, I started listening to, I already had one rental property, but during the pandemic, I started listening to a whole bunch of real estate investing podcasts. And I got more into it and I bought some more rental properties. And so, like, I kind of think that my financial legacy, you know, like, I don't have any children, but I'll just say that I've set things up so that people in my life who maybe are younger and have like a lot of student loans, like those people, like I'm leaving some things for them to be able to hopefully combat those financial barriers that may be a barrier to them acquiring a house or going back to graduate school or something along those lines. So that I really feel like is a big part of my purpose on this earth.
That is so meaningful and amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
That's very cool. I've got that firstborn on both sides of my family energy too.
Yeah.
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
That's a thing.
It's totally a thing. Yeah.
Wow. Very cool. What's your relationship like with your mom now?
My relationship with my mom, you know, growing up, she was always a big, like I said, a big supporter of me and kind of fostered that independent spirit that I have. But she was also someone that was struggling to raise two children as a single parent. And she struggled. She really struggled. And there were some things that happened that she's come back and made amends for some of those things that happened to me. And we currently, over the past couple of years, I've kind of had a little bit of distance from my mom because of some of those things still kind of carry over from childhood. And so I love my mother, but right now, you know, it's a challenge. So we are very much not in contact at this point. And, you know, I have a lot of friends in my support network who are just, you know, great. And I guess I'm just choosing at this point in my life to surround myself with the people who are really validating me as a person and see my worth. And so, you know, it's challenging to be a victim of crimes at a young age and to see your worth in this world. And I think a lot of the reason that I've really done all of these things, like been the overachiever, is because I was told at a young age that, you know, you're not really worth very much. We're willing to just kind of discard you because you brought out the family secret. Like, we don't want to have anything to do with you. And so through my life, I've tried to show people, and I've only come to this very recently, I've tried to show people that I have value and I have worth by accomplishing all of these things. But the past couple of years, I've really been focused on getting more in touch with me and validating my own self and telling myself, hey, like, I love you, Kelly. Like, you are worth something. You are worth being on this planet and existing. And like I said, I have friendships that go back decades, and those friends have been like my lifeline, you know, and I surround myself with great people who are going to lift me up and not lift me down. I mean, put me down, you know?
How did you do that?
So I, like I said, I'm a member of some 12-step programs. And one of the 12-step programs that I joined in the last couple of years is called Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And that program especially puts the experience of, so for a long time in my romantic relationships, I tried to get validation from outside sources, like from men, like to tell me how great I was. But with this program in particular, like I took a year and a half off of dating. And so
I've done that too.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's
oh, it helps you get super clear.
Yeah, it helps you get really clear. And so, yeah, like that.
Especially after a not good relationship.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Like, how the hell did I end up there?
Exactly. Exactly. Like, how do I keep ending up with these men who are emotionally stunted and are like totally unavailable as people, you know? And so, you know, like putting the focus back on myself and really, you know, like in the past couple of years, like I've always enjoyed hiking, but really finding the activities that I enjoy rather than like what someone else enjoys, that has been super, super important. And like I said, it's the little things like telling myself that I love myself or doing the earthing or journaling, writing gratitude lists. Like those are the little things that bring me back to myself and really bring the focus back on myself. And again, it's just that, you know, finding the people in my life that are going to validate me as a person and lift me up.
But as a little girl, that's really hard to discover those things.
Mm-hmm. Totally. It's very hard to discover those things.
And I don't feel like our parents' generation like encouraged those things.
Oh, no, 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 no. It was like, run out, please, and go play in the yard for hours and hours and don't come back. That was, you know, like,
total. That's not going to answer any questions. Like, that's not going to help you find yourself.
I know, exactly, exactly. But that was, yeah, 80s children, you know, that's what, you know, latchkey, coming home and watching the Disney Channel at 3:30 and eating sandwich cookies until mom got home to make dinner. You know, that was
totally,
that was how, that was my validation through sugar. Like, I love cookies and I love zoning out and watching cartoons.
Oh my God. And microwave burritos.
Yes.
I do want to go back to that year and a half thing. Yeah, because that's a big decision.
It's a huge decision.
How did you come to that decision? For me, it was actually encouraged by a cousin of mine who went to the Kabbalah Center and decided to kind of go through this spiritual change. And he was like, if you want to find the one, stop having sex. He was like, take a break from that. Literally, he encouraged that.
Totally. Yeah. That experience of, of not having sex for like 15 or 16 months, like, that was coming back into myself and like finding myself, like probably similar to going to a Kabbalah is just rediscovering me, and taking all that time off was fantastic. And then reframing and restructuring the way that I do relationships now, like old Kelly was like, oh, let me tell you everything there is to know about me on the first, second, third dates and have sex with you. And now, like, I piecemeal information out because my story is so trauma-filled that I only realized that, like, you just got to give bite-sized chunks, you know, like first date. We don't even talk about any of that stuff. We just keep it, like, light and polite. We just talk about movies, pets, car, I mean, work, and I don't venture into any of that stuff. Like, I just keep it very structured, and I don't sleep with people. I delay it as much as possible because that's where I go boop bananas, is after I have sex with someone. It's just like, okay, all bets are off. That's, yeah.
It's very intimate.
Mm-hmm. It's totally intimate. Yeah. And so by delaying as much as possible and keeping the focus on myself and also just like time blocking, like, hey, I'm going to hang out with you once a week and we're going to keep the time very brief. And then I'm going to come home and, you know, journal about what I liked and what I didn't like about, you know, what I just went through with you. And were you like on time? Were you treating me well? Were you talking nice about your coworkers or your children or whoever, whatever? And really just like analyzing and getting in there and looking at the other person and also myself and my reactions to what I experienced on those dates. So old Kelly never did any of that.
It sounds like you've done a lot of personal development.
Totally. Tons of personal growth and development.
Have you talked to other survivors that have not done the work that you've done?
Oh, like, yes. Yeah.
Do you see a difference in the work that you've done and potentially where people may have gotten stuck?
Yeah. I mean, the reality is most survivors have not done a lot of work because it's expensive. Like, therapy is expensive.
Yeah. And
healing is expensive. And so, you know, I recently joined the advisory board of this organization called Incest Aware. And Incest Aware is a collection of other survivors like myself who are doing a lot of work at the activist level. They're being interviewed for documentaries, or they're writing, or they're creating materials for children who are, you know, for school, like the difference between, like, about bodily autonomy and stuff of that nature. So working with those people who have all done such high level work on themselves is amazing versus interacting with someone who unfortunately just has so much unhealed trauma. It's so challenging. And, you know, like, I have kind of maybe like pie in the sky visions of partnering with or starting potentially a nonprofit where, like, in Scientology, ex-members have come out and created this thing called the Aftermath Foundation. And there's actually another one that's also come out where they're collecting donations and funds for people who are coming out of Scientology. And I think that the biggest thing that would be an advantage for sexual abuse survivors, incest survivors, would be a nonprofit where they could just get access to cash for therapy or body work, acupuncture. Like, I don't think that exists. And I think that I don't know if I really want to spearhead that, but, like, I think that would just be such a huge resource for people in a way that I could also kind of give back in a way that, you know, I do a lot of speaking out with my public-facing Instagram videos that I do, podcasts that I'm on. But I've always kind of wondered, like, man, it would be great if I could give survivors access to resources that, you know, they need.
What's your interest in the Scientology piece?
It's so funny. I don't know. Like, a couple years ago, you know, I started watching Aaron Smith Levin. Do you know who he is? Yeah, I started watching his YouTube show. And then, like, all of these other people have cropped up and popped out. And I think, you know, like, I didn't grow up in a cult and I have no interest in joining a cult. Like, I'll just make that really, really clear. Because a lot of my friends are just like, why are you so interested in this? This is so bizarre, you know? And so I think because my family's reaction to me, they locked down, they became very insular. And while they're not a cult, in many ways, they acted like a cult by kind of pushing me out, and no one would talk to me. No one would talk to my mom. I mean, I haven't really made any leaps and bounds towards reaching out to any of those family members, but I think in many ways, that's kind of that where that interest kind of comes in. And also, I'm very interested in how Scientology is making a difference by talking about, like, Danny Masterson and his victims and, you know, the cover-up that, you know, is going on or has been going on for a long time within Scientology, with covering up the crimes of people who have been molesting children within that organization for decades, most likely.
It's also interesting, like, how many celebrities have become
involved with it. Totally. And how many are leaving.
That, to me, is really interesting, too.
Yeah, totally. And just how much time people devote to this, like, the studies and... I don't know. It's.
I had no idea gross. That people, like, treated L. Ron Hubbard as, like, a deity.
I know.
That was shocking to me. And I'm like, who takes over next? Like, he's no longer with us.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then
what was the legacy plan there?
Exactly. And I find it so interesting, like, that he shunned psychiatry for so many years. And then I think I forget who was talking about how they did an autopsy on his body and they found that he had all kinds of, like, psychiatric drugs that he was within his system. And or like,
I didn't know
drugs.
That.
Yeah, I forget who was talking about that. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So you haven't tried to reach out to your dad or your grandfather after these years?
Well, my grandfather passed away in 1996. He was a lifelong smoker. He was a daily drinker. And when I was going on visits, my mom later told me, and I remember seeing there was always like Carnation instant breakfast out on the counter tops, but he was living off of beer, cigarettes, and Carnation instant breakfast mixed. Like he would make a milkshake with Carnation instant breakfast and ice cream. And that's how he could not eat solid food.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, he was in a bad way. And I was in college. I got an email from my dad in May 1996 or something. And my dad emailed to tell me, my dad and I were in some email communication at that point. And he said, your grandfather died, you know, he had lung cancer. He never went to the doctor. They found it in like May or something. And he died in June. So he was a very fast death. And I've gone in and out of, you know, like when he died, I was like, thank God he's not able to molest any more children. And then my dad and I have gone in and out of communication. I tried a reconciliation most recently. We went into a therapeutic reconciliation in 2013. My dad and I were in therapy for about a year. And then my dad had remarried in 1986. And my stepmom joined the therapeutic sessions. And we did that for another like 6-9 months. And then I started going out and going to family dinners, Thanksgiving, Christmas. But when we set the parameters of the therapeutic reconciliation, I at that point was like, I just want to have a relationship with my dad. He's getting older. We don't need to worry about, you know, like whether or not he believed me. And he to this day says he doesn't believe me. And so I was willing to put that aside to have a relationship with him and my family members. But as time went on, I got more and more uncomfortable with not being able to feel like I could talk about what happened to me at any of these family gatherings. Like, what do these people know? What do they think about me? Like, I was willing to, like, again, put that aside to have a relationship with my family. But in right before the pandemic, I had been having some feelings for a while of it's time to ask Dad, maybe, like, have you changed your mind? Do you believe me? And I needed to have that validation from him in order to continue the relationship. And so I hauled him into a therapy session and said, do you believe me? And he said, no, I don't believe you, basically. And I said, I can't continue to have a relationship with you. And I ended the reconciliation at that point. And so, yeah, my dad and I
not believe his daughter? I don't get that.
Well, my dad was always protecting my grandfather. My dad was a district attorney in the same county where my grandfather was charged with these crimes. And my dad, it later came out, a family member made allegations against him about sexual abuse. So like I said, it is generational within my family. And that family member, there was a police report filed, and then she backed down and said that nothing was happening. And it's deeply concerning, but, you know, I think that they stick together, pedophiles stick together. And that's the nature of what this dynamic is, you know? And
did it blip their record at all?
My dad was protected by the Eastern Oregon Good Old Boy Network because he had been a district attorney in the county where this took place. He was ingrained in the police and with law enforcement, you know, every aspect. It's so rural. The county that he was a judge in, you know, the largest town is like 15,000 people out there. And so it's small. And
you think moving to a small town, you're like safe from this stuff. Like, that's why people move to small towns. They want the country living.
What? No, it's like
that's they want no neighbors close by.
Exactly. That's where this happens.
Oh my God. That's where it happens.
And it festers in these communities. And
God.
Yeah.
Can we be safe anywhere?
That's a good question. On a remote island?
Not even that. Oh my God. They do it there too.
I know, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You need an arsenal.
I know, you totally need an arsenal.
Sons of bitches.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. And another question too is like, does time really heal?
Well, I mean, I think this is something that I'll struggle with for the rest of my life. And so I don't know. I mean, I think I just develop other coping mechanisms. I develop thicker skin. I develop ways of living and existing in this life, you know, like being in my body on a daily basis is a struggle because, you know, like I want to be out of my body. And I think it's a way of like dissociating. And so like I rush through things. Like I drink a lot of coffee in the morning to like get my system revved up. And then
hell yeah,
I'm like, let's go. Let's do this. Let's do this. And so when I'm able to just like, okay, just look around, like, oh, you're sitting in a chair. You are recording a podcast. You don't have anywhere else to be. Just like sit and enjoy where you are. That is something that, you know, on a daily basis is something that I struggle with, is just being calm and centered, and which is why I do the hiking and the connecting with nature, because it really brings me back to my body and centers me in a way that nothing else can.
I love that.
Yeah.
Do you think that everyone who's been sexually assaulted should have therapy or share that story?
Oh, it's such a personal choice, you know, and therapy doesn't always work for people. Some people have like horrific nightmare experiences in therapy, or maybe they've been forcibly admitted to like a psych unit and they have trauma there. Like, I think there's all kinds of different ways to heal. For me, therapy was the best and the most effective way to get help. And there are 12-step programs. There are support groups for other people who are survivors. There's all different types of ways to heal. There's yoga retreats. I mean, there's so many different ways. Like, there's a multitude. Like, so whether or not someone wants to come out and tell their story, like I said, it's a traumatizing thing to repeatedly tell your story. Like, I'm comfortable with it because I've told this story so many flipping times. So it loses its power over time. But it's, like I said, it's such a deeply personal thing. And you just have to be in the right frame of mind to be able to tell your story.
I love that you've brought up the 12-step process. That is free, right? Like,
totally free.
Join that.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally free.
Like, I think they even have it on Zoom now.
Oh, there's tons. You can join any 12-step meeting practically. There's meetings around the world, like on Zoom, free. I mean, yeah.
I feel like that's a safe way to kind of like tippy-toe into it even.
Totally. I mean, someone that I worked with early on, like 12-step programs are not the bedrock of mental health, but it's free and there's all kinds of, you know, peer support. That's like, I think it's such an important part of recovery, is that peer support where you're sharing with another person who has gone through what you've gone through, and yeah, connecting, you know, because it's all about connecting with people. What,
have you had any moments in having shared your story that you're like, I am so glad I did this? Like, talk about, I mean, you've had some of your videos go completely viral. What has come of that?
Yeah, I mean, just watching, like, I recorded an interview with this organization called Unfiltered Stories, and it went viral. I think it's at 5 million views now, like almost a year later. And that experience was just completely bonkers, just to have that many people. And then I recorded an Instagram video that it hit 500,000 after a couple days in October, and I was away at a writing retreat in North Carolina with a girlfriend that I've known for a long time. And I was just like at this retreat watching the numbers go up like every hour, and I was like, what is going on? This is crazy. But that experience of seeing people in like the comment section say, what a complete injustice, I went through this too. I mean, there's some wackadoos that I had to like block and stuff, but there's always going to be a wackadoo or two. But like 99.5% of all the responses were so positive and uplifting. It's like fuel for me to keep going and share my story, you know?
Hell yes.
Yeah.
I had a couple wackadoos in the comments out of like 500. And then you're like, okay, I'm going to entertain that for about a half a second.
Exactly. Thank you for your opinion. Next, please.
Yeah, but that is super powerful. One other question I did see in the comments of your story was, where was Children Protective Services? And
What role do they play? What have you learned about that?
My experience was that because right before I told my mom what was happening, my parents had gone through a nasty divorce and Children's Services was involved. There was a caseworker who had been assigned to kind of, I don't know like what the extent was, but I think they were just trying to be maybe more of like a mediator between my parents. And so Children's Services was there. My mom called the case manager when this happened and told her. So they were the ones that gave referrals out for the early intervention therapy. So I was assigned a therapist, and then that therapist also ran a girls group of other incest survivors like myself. So I was in individual therapy and then this girls group where I was, you know, sharing my experience with other little girls in a therapeutic setting. But the unfortunate thing was that I can't remember if it was a caseworker or a social worker that had been assigned, called my dad. There was no HIPAA laws back then. Called my dad at work and told him about my allegations. And then my dad took the rest of the day off of work and went to my grandfather's house out in the country, summoned all the relatives. And that's where they developed the alibi to why this couldn't have happened, which was that my grandfather was trampled by cows and he was not physically able to molest me because of the positioning of the way that he was in the bed. And so that social worker done messed up, like really messed up. And I actually found her and emailed her several years ago. And she was like, initially she was like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I don't know who you are. Like that wasn't me. And then I emailed her back and I was like, actually, here's what happened. And she's not a social worker anymore. She's like a minister, but I told her and she apologized to me.
Oh, hell yeah. That's amazing. You got an apology.
I did, but it was like a little too late. Like 30 years later, that would have been, you know, like why? What was your motivation for tipping my dad off? And yeah, so it's Children's Services at that point. It was like a mixed bag, obviously, you know.
Wow. Was she able to like explain herself at all, or it was just an apology?
It was just an apology, pretty much. I can't recall. I mean, it was, I'm pretty sure it's just like, I'm so sorry I inflicted harm on you in this way. And
wow,
I wish you the best of luck in your healing. So
damn, well, she has to live with herself.
Yep.
And you know what? Having to live with that on your conscience is a lot.
It is a lot. It's a lot. Yeah. Yeah.
And that alibi
happened today. Yeah. And the alibi, you know, like, I mean, I've explained this in other podcasts, but like the alibi that they developed, my grandfather was never medically verified. It was like an old injury. It was like from a year earlier. And like, it was never medically verified by any independent doctor outside of a family member. And so it was, I mean, hello.
I'm like, how'd they come up with that? That's actually some creative shit.
It's some very creative shit. Thanks, Dad.
Wow.
Yeah. Thanks, Dad.
I mean, I don't think that excuse has ever been used any other time.
Probably not. It's super creative.
That kind of reminds me of like the crazy things people try to come up with to get out of jury duty.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I mean,
trampled by a cow. Mm-hmm. Can't go to jury duty today. Yeah.
How did you feel even in hearing that? I mean, that must have sounded so outlandish.
As a child, I can't really remember, but as an adult, it's just completely bonkers. You know, it's like how any jury could have believed that is.
A straight face even hearing that.
Mm-hmm.
That seems made up.
It's super made up. It's super made up because it was made up. And, you know, like the testimony in the trial was, it was basically writing on my testimony as an 8-year-old who is in a court setting, which was very traumatizing. Like, I wasn't the greatest witness. I mean, I was not a good witness. I did the best that I could. And also the trial took place a year after I came forward. So my memory wasn't as strong and my testimony wasn't as strong as if, you know, it was originally supposed to be 5 months after I disclosed. It would have been a whole different story, but my dad and the legal team that my grandfather hired were able to come up with delay tactics. They're like Trump. Like, let's just put delay, 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 delay as much as we can in the process to hopefully get Kelly to back down and stop talking. And that didn't work. But there were other women, there were other people that came forward that were involved with FFA and 4-H, and they were interviewed by police, but their testimony was not admissible in court. So if that had been entered into court or they'd gone to testify, that would have been a whole other story. You know, it's usually not court cases. If there's more than one person, especially with sexual assault, that we've seen that with like Bill Cosby. It's like you have to have 60 women come forward and say that it happened. And even with that, it's like we're not believed. And
even trafficking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They delay it so much mm-hmm. that I don't think the majority hold out for that.
No, 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 no.
The it's court incredibly... system is so hard.
It's super hard. And like I said, I think we've done a little bit better, but it's just being involved in any kind of legal case is incredibly stressful, whether it's you're just giving like a small amount of testimony or a huge amount of testimony. It's just, I don't know. It's really hard. And it's hard as an adult. Like I can't really go into a courtroom. I mean, I can, but my friend was going through like a nasty contentious divorce. She asked me to go and support her, but oh my gosh, it was really hard. It's really hard to be in a courtroom. So that, yeah, just saying.
Wow. And also, yeah. I heard you talk about, too, like a lie detector test and some other kind of test.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Yeah. So my grandfather took a lie detector test 2 months after my allegations came out. My dad hired a polygrapher to come and meet with my grandfather in a motel room, and they did a polygraph in court. I mean, polygraphs are not admissible in court, but my grandfather failed the polygraph, and my dad thought that he was going to pass, and he did not. There were only four questions that were asked, and they were all directly related to child sexual abuse, and I think my name was brought up in one of like, have you ever had sexual feelings toward a child or something along those lines? And he was like, no, but it found that he was deceptive in that. And so, yeah, he failed that. And I don't know that in Oregon, they are not admissible in court. So that was not brought forward. But I mean, the good thing is that my mom is an excellent recorder of records, and she has kept every single possible scrap receipt lawyer bill from my grandfather's. Well, okay, so my grandfather, the documents from that, the transcripts were lost in a flood. And my mom, when my mom originally tried to get the court transcripts a couple months after the court case ended. And she didn't have the money. She was a graduate student. She was raising two children and living on student loans. She didn't have the money to get the entire court transcript, but she got my testimony. And so we have that. I mean, it's like sitting right next to me on the floor here in a binder. But my mom called back, I want to say like a year later, and she talked to a court clerk who said, those files, we put them in the basement and they were lost in a flood. And there's not a lot of rain in it rains in Oregon, but Eastern Oregon is very dry. And it was the summertime. And it's so weird that these court documents are suddenly lost to a flood. So they're gone. There's only my testimony. But what my mom was also able to discover during that phone call, when she called, the court clerk said, yeah, those documents are gone, but there was another trial. There was a civil suit. Do you want those documents? So unbeknownst to my mom, my grandfather sued the state of Oregon, the police detectives, my therapist,
and
social workers for $1 million in a defamation case. And he lost. But my mom was able to get the testimony, which is how we were able to figure out more about this secret meeting that they had with the developing the alibi. We didn't know. My dad testified in that civil suit extensively about that meeting. And so that's how I know about that secret meeting that they had and all of that stuff. So I have all of those documents right next to me on the floor. Like, there are categories in, my mom put them in 9 different binders. They're huge. And I just had them like electronically scanned a couple of years ago because it's like, what if my house burned down?
Wasn't there some like penile lie detector test thing too?
Oh, yes. So let me go back to explain how this loops back in. So there was a third trial. My dad tried to get custody of my sister and I 2 years after the case with my grandfather. And the police reports from the other family member who had alleged that my dad sexually abused her, those were admitted into evidence. And the judge in that custody trial ordered my dad, oh, first of all, he denied custody to my dad and my stepmom and ordered court-supervised visits with my sister and I only, and ordered my dad to sex offender treatment. And part of that was taking this thing called a penile phasismograph, which is basically...
I can't believe you can remember even how to say that.
We were just talking about, I had a few friends over on Saturday night, and I don't know, somehow that got brought up. Not mine. I mean, not the penile phasismograph with my dad, but someone else was just talking about it, and she was talking about how you pronounce it. And so it's a little fresh in my memory. But it's like this contraption. It's like you hook up this device to a penis and you show images of child porn. And if there's supposed to be like a response if you have a reaction. And it's like a 1980, it seems like a 1980s like torture device. Like, hello, let's, like, who came up with that? I don't know if they use that still. But so my dad was able to get out of that, and the court supervised visits, he never took the court up on. And he was supposed to go to this sex offender treatment program in Eastern Oregon, and he got out of it because of his legal connections. And then he became district attorney in that county, and then he became a judge.
I still can't believe that.
It's bonkers. It's a legal system that was set up by white men in the 1700s and benefits them to this day. And like I said, sex offenders protect one another. And if there are, I'm sure there's tons of them in there. I'm sure of it.
As a mother,
yeah,
I just do not like hearing that. Like, how can we protect our daughters?
That is a really good question. Educate them on consent, body parts, just like start having age appropriate conversations.
And even talking to my sons. I have 3 mm-hmm. sons.
Yeah. Consent is a really good thing. Consent is your friend. Talking about early.
It's almost like a new word.
It's so new. And
did you ever hear that word?
No, not until recently. I mean, it's so funny. I was watching like Seinfeld, and there was a scene where like a guy just like grabs Elaine and starts kissing her. And it's like, hello, that was what we grew up. That was like completely normalized. You know, that mm-hmm. was the sitcom TV reality. That's what we watched 80s, 90s when we didn't have a million channels. We didn't have YouTube. So that's what we saw. And the whole consent thing is so new and it's so foreign. And, you know, just even going on a date a couple months ago, a guy was like, can I hold your hand? Like asking to hold my hand. He's like, oh yeah, consent. That's a good thing, right? And I was like, oh yeah, it is a good thing. But yeah, it's like seeping in slowly into our vocabulary and our culture, you know?
I personally think that's sweet.
It was so sweet.
Like, don't even think, like, there's too much consent. Like, that can literally be for, like, every step of the warm-up process.
Exactly. Totally. Exactly.
I mean, it might be a little awkward at first, but
yeah,
I think it would be, like, appreciated.
Totally. It was definitely appreciated by me because, yeah, it makes a huge difference.
I love that. Is there anything you want to ask my dad? This is going to be quite an interesting conversation between the two of us.
Yeah, I'm just super curious. I don't know if I have anything to ask, but I'm just like super curious to see like what his response is going to be. Like, I'm so excited. It's such a like interesting concept that I've never been a part of a show like this. So I'm super excited to see what he says.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think that there are real generational differences.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to hear like his take from the experience that he's had. Mm-hmm. Also, my dad is a dad to three daughters. So.
Oh, interesting.
He definitely never talked to us about consent, but it would have been a good idea.
Totally.
You've heard from my mom. Now, let's switch it over to Grandpa.
Wow, this is really a tough episode.
Yeah. I had trouble sleeping after this interview.
Well, Kelly, what a candid interview and showing full emotion and really taking it the whole history of what's happened. Quite a presentation. You would think that she took it well and has been able to adjust. But the truth of the matter is that she's also relayed in the interview. This is something you have to work on to get over your whole life. And she wants to share her story to maybe prevent or educate young ladies what's out there. And there's predators out there. And as you brought up in the interview, people are even in the business of selling young girls, not more than 8 or 9 or 10 years old, and make them sex slaves. So this still goes on 20 years later. So the issue of consent, what does that mean? A boy asks you in high school, let's get it on, had a few beers, you've partied a little bit, and let's do it, let's try it, see if we like it. The girl says, well, I'm not sure, but yeah, maybe I'll like it. Let's see how far it goes. The fact is that, is there a standard of rules that really exists? And as you said, she says, well, my dad didn't go over the rules of sexual behavior in high school. So the truth of the matter is that what's in bounds and what's not in bounds? And to predators, they don't believe in guilt of any kind. Okay? Someone who's a sex offender, they don't think they're a sex offender. They even, as you know, from someone that worked in our factory, took videos of it all. Thought it was a trophy to get a young girl to do whatever he wanted. It was almost like a way to be in control of another human life, like almost like godlike, they think, that they were able to achieve something that is, they think is even wonderful. And yet, it's just the opposite, just horrible. And for someone in your own family, a grandfather or a father, to subdue their own child or a young teenager shows how hurting and how desperate those type of people are, and where they have absolutely no caring, no sense of legacy, certainly for the future of their own family, and are willing to destroy it and give them a psychological issue or problem their whole life without hesitation. That's certainly not godlike. That's really a definition of not caring and maybe a borderline evil.
Definitely evil.
So this episode brings out a lot of issues. And I wish I could just off the cuff answer all of these things that are bouncing in my head. Like you say, this is one where I might even have to sleep on it a little bit further, because there's a lot in this. And then, of course, your court system comes up We're in a small town. Small town politics can even be played, where if the family is connected to the town, they're certainly not going to believe a little young girl. And it's not only the grandfather that is a predator, but her own father is a predator. And they're certainly going to protect each other or have secret meetings to make sure that they can get out of this thing. And the way the court systems work, if you have money and you have connections, you can delay and delay and delay justice from really occurring. And not only that, but the cards can be stacked against you, where even if you're innocent or you're guilty of something, that doesn't mean that you're going to win in court.
And the witnesses drop off.
Not only do the witnesses drop off, but people also, there's a lot of people allergic to funerals. A lot of people are allergic to the courtroom. They don't want any part of it. They want to look the other way. They don't want to be involved. So the sad part is that the father and mother break up. He finds a new girl. He's willing to even adopt her sister or take control and have them live with the new setup. And some of these court cases, they could be caught in dispositions lying. And still, a lot of this stuff isn't even admissible in court. And even losing different cases, even had the audacity to sue back for defamation when they're as guilty as hell. Because predators don't have any guilt. And we've learned this over and over and over again, that they don't think they do anything wrong, that their shit don't stink. And not only does it stink, but you can't wait to flush it down the toilet. It stinks so bad. And Kelly, you've come out of this where you have come up with the right even formula for what sexual relations should be. It should be someone that you know, someone that you love, someone that you can get along with, someone that you would be willing to share your life with. It's not just the slam bam thank you man, which is sometimes what boys learn when they're growing up, okay, is that the best time is jumping in the sack and not worry about all of the girl talk afterwards. And that's just the opposite of what even a young man should learn, is that to have a relationship, it's more than just slam bam thank you man. And there's responsibilities to these actions, because sometimes a little slip can make a little baby. And what are you supposed to do? Run for the high hills if that happens? Or is there a responsibility to not only to the girl, but to your son or your daughter that you might have just made? And that responsibility goes on your whole life if you really care and you really want to be a good person. So the truth of the matter is that there's a lot of people having sex out there that don't give a rat's ass about anything or the person sometimes or the responsibility of their action, just to feel good for a moment. And that's all they can think of, where it's not complicated at all because they have no feeling of guilt or any conscience. And that's the sad part of the episode, is that there's a lot of people that are out there in this world where they really take sex for granted and don't really get involved in all of the variables that go with it. And I agree with you. If you're going to go out and you're dating or you're looking to have a good time with someone, to share that intimacy with someone, you would think that it's not just to get a high and just to give yourself some physical pleasure for a second when there's so much more to it, or there should be a lot more to it. And I guess that comes down to where you should have some morality. And it does seem in today's times, it's not much different than when I grew up, where morality can be challenged as being still a very low grade. Certainly with all the technological breakthroughs that we've made and all the improvements that we've made in human life, yet morality still seems to be on the back page with a lot of people.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah, and I wish I could tell Kelly that one day she'll get her justice. But maybe, like I said, God moves in mysterious ways. It's made you a stronger person, and maybe you can help other people is a way to get redemption. And as well as your grandfather, I'm sure had a very painful death at the end. He ended up getting cancer and getting infected and getting eaten away. And I hate to say this, but I think he got what he deserved. But it's not for us to make that judgment. Let God take care of people that really have evil inclinations. And we've got to learn to overcome those type of choices and see if we can be better people. And sometimes some terrible experiences we can go through, but we can actually be stronger people for sometimes what happens to us, and we can maybe help other people graduate to a higher level. And that's what, Kelly, I would suggest that you continue to try to do.
Thanks for listening. Now I think I'm going to go call my dad.
I'll say goodbye and see you the next time.
Thanks for listening to the Better Call Daddy show. Join us weekly for new episodes and more daddy wisdom.
Better Call Daddy is good advice always.
And love you, Grandpa, and love you, Mommy.
That's so cute.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. You can also find special episodes on my YouTube channel, and you can listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Alexa,
and Good Pods,
or your preferred podcatcher. That's a wrap for now.